To me, the utopia is that frontline charities can solely focus on doing their frontline impact and not have to worry about fundraising, because more and more humanitixes of the world are popping up. Here's all of our profits, and you're going to focus exclusively on creating that change.
If you've ever been surprised by your own thoughts, well, you're not alone. From the time we're born to the time we die, we spend our lives meeting strangers, including the one within. We also spend our lives learning about many of those strangers and turning them into colleagues, friends, and family. In this podcast, host Charlie Bressler talks with fascinating people on their musings about family, community, work, helping others, and getting to know the stranger inside ourselves. Where do we fit in the world we all inhabit together? Charlie Bressler, the co-founder of The Life You Can Save and former president of a large international retail company, investigates ideas that he has been musing on since he obtained his PhD in clinical and social psychology way back in 1984.
We delayed this episode a little bit so we could make an exciting announcement. Between recording this conversation in March, when I was with Josh Ross and Adam McCurdy in Sydney, and releasing it on the podcast, Josh and Adam's nonprofit, Humanitix, has donated $4 million Australian dollars to the Life You Can Save. A rare combination of brains, drive, and generosity has enabled them to make this transformational grant to the Life You Can Save. My hope is that this partnership between Humanitix and the Life You Can Save will save and improve the lives of hundreds of thousands, even millions of people living in poverty over the coming years. I'm delighted to be able to share with you a bit of the Humanitix story, including how they set up their truly unique nonprofit. If you've ever bought tickets for a concert or sporting event, you probably used an online ticket seller and paid a hefty fee for the service. Humanitix not only charges less, has a superior user interface than their competitors, but amazingly donates 100% of their profits to nonprofits. Welcome, Josh and Adam. It is truly a pleasure. Josh and Adam, it is truly a pleasure to have you here today. And here happens to be Sydney, Australia, so the home where Josh and Adam live and where I'm visiting with my wife, partly for work, partly on holiday. So it's quite an unusual setting. And Deloitte has been generous in letting us use their studio for the second time, which is where we're doing the podcast. So Josh and Adam, thank you very much for being here today. I would like to start off with you telling your story about your early days together, your relationship, and how it evolved into this thing called Humanitix. After you've told your story, and maybe it'll be part of your story, I'd like to ask you some more details about Humanitix and what it is, because I do think that it is extraordinary. Not that you have a ticketing platform, but I think it seems that you're really extraordinary that you have a ticketing platform that is going to do so much good for the world. And I think that's unusual. I'm groping for the word because I don't want to use extraordinary again. The other thing I want to tell the audience is, as you hear this story, think about the normal technology company that starts and fails. Most of them do. They're startups, they have an idea, and they don't succeed. What you'll hear is that Adam and Josh's company is not only succeeding, but succeeding really well. Most tech entrepreneurs, and maybe Josh and Adam can correct me when they talk, but they have the idea that they're going to build something that's going to be so valuable that some bigger entity is going to want to buy them, and they're going to buy them for a lot of money once they've proven their concept, and they can get very rich. Josh and Adam's story is amazing to me, because that's not what their goal was from the very beginning, and that's not where this is headed. So I'm going to make a statement that I know they would disagree with, but given that I work for Peter Singer, who is one of the most generous people I've ever met, I have to say that Josh and Adam and their families are the most generous people I've ever met. And if I do the math for you at the end, perhaps you'll understand what that generosity is all about. So with that long introduction from me, I'll turn to you, Adam, first and ask you if you can tell the story of your beginning of your relationship with Josh and how Humanitix started. And given that there are two of you, which has only happened once during my podcast interviews, you're going to have to figure out who talks when. I'm starting with Adam, but you two go back and forth or interrupt each other, which I imagine must happen in your meetings and probably has always happened if you have a normal friendship
Never.
And business relationship. So I leave it to you, Adam, to start, but I have no idea where this is going to go.
Cool. Thanks again, Charlie. Yeah, really a pleasure to be here. Josh and I first came across each other in high school. We were in different grades, so knew of each other, but didn't really have much to do with each other. It was then after school that we started to cross paths. Both of us studied at university here in Sydney, but we started to share common interests and activities, and particularly was travel when we were studying at university. Like a lot of, I think, university kids, we were grappling with knowing that our degrees were about to finish. We studied different degrees. I was in engineering, Josh is studying finance, and really trying to grapple with the idea of what do we do next? How do we apply our time and skills and attention? The ability to travel a lot was huge. We did a bunch of trips. The one that we did right towards the end of our studies was particularly formative was going to Sri Lanka. We were there just after the Civil War finished, traveling around the south coast, doing a lot of surfing, meeting local families, these types of things. And it was a real awesome trip where we could set a lot of intention as a friendship. And to be honest, I'm so grateful for that trip because in life you get a lot of moments and periods where you've got these thoughts floating around in your head. They might be eating you alive with stuff that you want to do, but you're not quite sure how to do it. And if you don't have a friend, like in my case, like Josh, they stay in your head and they sometimes eat you alive. But in this trip, we got to share that. And there was one night in particular, we kind of just finished a hike in the middle of the country somewhere. And we're like, well, what do we want to do with our lives? And how do we navigate this challenge of living in a city like Sydney, you know, wanting to have a family, go down a career path? But how do we do the things that we both intuitively and research suggests makes for a happy life? And that's finding meaningful work and cultivating great relationships. And often a career can be at odds with meaningful work and also at odds with meaningful relationships because it can often come at the cost of cultivating great relationships. And we were just very keenly aware of that being a path that we might find ourselves going down if we're not active in pursuing what we want to do.
So intentionality was a big part of what you two were coming together on, because it's one thing to have the idea. The intentionality is maybe how you activate those ideas.
Yeah. And we didn't even have an idea specifically at the time. It's exactly what you say. It was an intention. It was we both want to do something that's meaningful and impactful and good, but very difficult to know what that is. But if we go at it alone, we're both terrified that that's going to be a lonely path while maybe all of our peers are pursuing, you know, careers. And, you know, if you take a more direct, more obvious path, you know, your gains are going to be a lot quicker early on. And if you're not taking a traditional path, that could be quite lonely and scary. And so it was an intention to team up together to take an untraditional, unconventional path for the sake of meaningful work and good relationships.
So your core values were part of what that intention was, and that involved relationships and meaningful work. But meaningful work, did you have an idea at that point what meaningful work might be? Josh, you can also answer these questions. You can't let Adam hog the microphone.
I'll just say that.
I'm joking.
Yeah. For me, and I think Josh too, it was the idea of giving back and using your position and the tools that you have available to give somebody else a shot and give somebody else an opportunity and to do what is common sense, decent goodness in the world that can cultivate itself in many different ways, but being honest with ourselves about how to help other people and other people in very, very different circumstances to the two of us who went to a great high school growing up in Sydney with loving families.
Did being in Sri Lanka inform any of the thoughts you were having about how you might intentionally help other people? Did that have any impact? Because it obviously had come through an incredibly difficult time, if people are not aware of what happened in Sri Lanka during the civil war. And there were a lot of people living in poverty and a lot of really terrible things that happened.
Yeah, it definitely did. And we'd done quite a lot of traveling in low-income countries, which had informed, you know, our perspective of just how lucky we are and the moral duty that comes with to help others that don't have that, you know, winning a lottery ticket as to where you're born and in what context. But one really interesting element I remember us both reflecting on was while we were still studying, we'd both started working in some type of corporate grind. And we were both quite fearful of getting trapped in that. And we'd seen people getting trapped in that who had big dreams and ambitions and ideals that they defer to a later time in life because you just can't see a feasible path to do it today.
Are you talking to me?
Well, we've all done our trades, right? Adam, we've both done our time. And we were both just very, you know, coming to the end of our university degrees, we're like, well, how do we escape that trap? Because you get a graduate job and then you're in it. We did a pact together that we would support each other once we had the right idea to do it. And we actually created a promise to each other. And, you know, I went and worked in a hedge fund for 7 years, and Adam's promise was he'd get me out if I was there for longer than 5 years.
But he didn't. You had two more years after the five.
And that's part of the story. But yeah. So,
did he visit you in jail from time to time?
Yeah, exactly. But the other thing, traveling in other parts of the world, was we recognized, you know, in a country like Australia, you can't starve to death. There's nothing you can do that's going to cause you to starve to death. And so you really don't have much to lose in taking a gamble or a risk on doing something outside the box. Sure, you might set back your traditional savings and career by a year or two, but there's really not that much downside in a country like Australia where the safety net and the welfare state is so strong. And so we recognize what a shame if we don't roll the dice and try, because that's where our hearts and dreams are at. And so it was really that, what Adam was alluding to before, that fear of doing it alone and loneliness that we saw as the most likely thing to keep us trapped, in a sense, from chasing what we wanted to chase. And
were either of you married at this point during this hedge fund stint? Or I've met Josh's wife, I haven't met your wife, Adam, but when did those relationships start? Didn't, how did they play into this?
A year before we started Humanitics, I started dating a girl, Natalie, who's now my wife.
Uh-huh.
She's been with us the whole journey, which has been interesting because obviously starting a business with somebody else is an intimate relationship all on its own. So.
And Taryn, Josh, your wife, when did that, I don't remember the timing of.
We met during COVID. She thought I was unemployed because I worked in events.
Okay. So a little bit later than Josh, your marriage started.
Yeah, no, it was only 3 years ago.
Well, I can say I met Josh's wife the other day and she's an extraordinary pediatrician and mother, and when I talk about the generosity that you'll uncover when you go through the numbers later on in this podcast, I have to say that Natalie and Taryn are part of that, because if they're supporting this, they're supporting the idea of having a comfortable life but not becoming very wealthy. And I think, anyway, that's a theme I'd like to explore, because I think that's what makes this story so amazing.
We actually haven't told them that all the equity of Humanitics goes to charity.
Okay. So, well, no wonder Terrence seems so happy with you, Josh. Anyway, continue.
And then we, you know, as university students, we also read a range of books that kind of put us, you asked about, did we have the idea? We didn't have the Humanitics idea, but we had an idea of what purpose and meaning and interesting work could look like. And that was inspired by characters like Muhammad Yunus, starting Grameen Bank. We read Banker to the Poor. There was a range of different inspirations out there that we'd read over the years, including The Life You Can Save.
It sounded like from my conversation with Taryn the other day, she was a Peter Singer fan as well.
Yeah. When I met Peter the first time, I thanked him for getting me a second date, because when I knew who she was on our date, she had read his book at 14 and become a vegan. She gave me a second date because I knew who he was.
After meeting Taryn, I think you were very lucky to get a second date.
Agreed.
So this journey continued. These two close friends are intentionally trying to do something that will get Josh out of the corporate grind and start actualizing these values to help other people. If you're ready for this, maybe the next thing for you to do is to explain to people, what is Humanitics? How does it work? And how is it the vehicle for actualizing your goals?
Adam was working in management consulting and technology, and I was working in a hedge fund in the investment team. And we recognize that technology is one of the biggest drivers of change in the world, but it's also making the most money of any industry. And so trying to look for a career and purpose, we stumbled across the social enterprise sector, which was incredibly exciting to two young guys who were crafting their skills in commercial avenues. This was a way of mixing the two and potentially having the most impact we could have. And so we kind of surveyed the landscape and thought, there's no technology social enterprises. So why is the sector not using technology to create change? That doesn't make sense. It's one of the most powerful tools we have. At the end of 2015, we decided we're going to go for it. We're going to build a technology social enterprise. And so Adam...
And how old were you at this point? Because I'm looking at you
26.
And I know how young you are, but our audience doesn't know how young you
are. We were 26.
You were 26.
Yeah. So Adam had the better skill set to go all in on that. And so at the end of 2015, on a handshake, we decided I'll stay at the hedge fund. And that's why it turned from 5 to 7 years.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
And we'll split my salary and I'll support him to start Humanitix, you know, work weeknights and weekends. And we both moved back to our parents' houses. And we live around the corner because we went to the same high school. And we grounded out. And after about 16 months, Adam had done such a good job that I could quit the job and join him full time. And at that point, we were volunteering for quite a while, but with no income. But I didn't answer your question, which is, what is Humanitix?
Is this a good point to do that, do you think? Maybe, Adam, since you were the technologist, maybe you should start in on explaining what it is and then getting into the economic structure. Because even though it's technical, I want to make sure that the audience understands how these companies are valued when they're sold and what the amount of money that not only you're giving up, but the amount of money that could then be transferred to highly impactful charities helping people.
Yeah,
but
sure.
I think we've got to bring the audience along to understand what is Humanitix.
Sure. So as Josh is alluding to, we were inspired by this idea of social enterprise. And social enterprise has taken many forms over the years with different companies adopting the model in different ways. It's basically where a company seeks to do good beyond what traditionally a company of that nature would be doing for the world. And that can be done in a few ways, but the most compelling way is a company that makes a profit and decides to give it all away to very, very effective charities that do a phenomenal job. And so essentially what you can do is run a company in a near identical fashion to how a company would be run. But rather than having shareholders who are expecting for that profit to prop up the company's equity value and enrich themselves with the value of the shares going up, instead, the company is structured as a non-profit with no equity value whatsoever, which frees up the organization to make its profit and distribute its profit freely to making its stated impact goals, which is most commonly done via teaming up with great charities.
At that point, were you aware of other social enterprises that were using a similar model?
Yes. We're inspired locally here. There's a great company called Thank You. They started off with bottled water that's now moved into soaps. There are social enterprise cafes we saw pop up. You know, for every coffee that you buy, they'll then donate a portion from that to, you know, some type of fund that's doing good jobs. What's exciting to us is that we saw social enterprise mainly being adopted in fast-moving consumer goods and hospitality. That's where social enterprise lived. And it's a very compelling model in a way that you can do good for the world. But what stood out to me and Josh as what's not yet being done is, why don't you try pull this off in technology? Why not try pull this off in software? Software as a service right now is dominating and making so much money. So if you were to make a social enterprise who creates its impact by giving away its profit, let's try disrupt it, an industry that's dominated by software rather than, you know, hospitality and fast-moving consumer goods, which is a totally different industry. And that's when we started to look at which industry dominated by technology might be a great fit to make a social enterprise that redistributes 100% of all the profit it makes into the world's best charities.
And disruption, you use the word disruption. Can you explain to the audience what you mean by disruption?
Disruption because...
Sounds like Donald Trump sometimes.
Yeah. Well, it's disruption because in order to make a profit in an industry and be a competitive player, you have to compete with the other players in that industry. In our case, we've gone into events ticketing. So Humanitix is the events ticketing solution for thousands of different events all across the world right now. That's everyone who's running a big music festival all the way down to a 10-person yoga class and everything in the middle, which might be conferences or schools, universities, societies, associations, etc. That's synonymous with booking fees as an industry. Everyone hates paying that booking fee on top of their ticket. It's heavily resented, and there's a lot of dodgy behavior by the industry in that regard. And Humanitix comes in with a very different model. We lower booking fees for everyone because booking fees are too high. The platform has fantastic features that event hosts benefit from when running their events. But most importantly, from a social enterprise idea, we don't have any shareholders. And so all the profit we make from those booking fees gets donated to the world's best charities. Why do we disrupt? The reason we disrupt is because in order for somebody to use Humanitix, they have to use Humanitix instead of a traditional incumbent in events ticketing, in our case. And that's true of every social enterprise trying to be the social enterprise in their industry that would most likely be dominated by non-social enterprises, traditional businesses with shareholders who seek to make money and enrich the shareholders.
What are some of those companies, if you don't mind mentioning?
Well, the most famous one with Taylor Swift debacle in the last 12 months was Ticketmaster.
Ticketmaster. I've heard of that in the States.
Yeah, and they're dominant in Australia as well. And so people are sick, broadly speaking, in the ticketing industry of paying excessive booking fees, hidden fees, you know, companies that bully artists and entertainers and venues and event managers, give terrible customer service, have a dodgy secondary market practices. And so that's the industry as it is today. And we thought, how compelling to go in there with an ethical point of difference where the value proposition is so strong. It's not just an ethical point of difference. It's we're going to fix customer service. We're going to reasonably price. We're going to create an amazing piece of software that doesn't try to take advantage of the event organizer through, you know, a range of different issues. It's everything that's wrong with industry, we're going to try and fix. And ticketing's just been one of those industries that stands out that everyone hates for good reason.
And you weren't necessarily particularly interested in concerts or ticket acquisition or any of that. It just seemed, correct me if I'm wrong, like an industry that would be open to being disrupted and wasn't being managed well.
Yes.
Is that correct?
A resented industry dominated by technology that's very scalable. That's a great combo to potentially win as a social enterprise.
There was strong virality in the product. So you can win an event organizer and then get your brand out to his 10,000 patrons. And of those 10,000 patrons, a percentage will be event organizers who now learn about your software. And you don't get that with, say, bottled water.
You know, right.
You're a retail person buying bottled water in the supermarket.
A single user. Yeah. These are people who have the capacity then to throw an event and bring in more ticket buyers. And so convincing event people, even who make small events, to use it, spread your product.
That and that we made it no barrier to entry for an event organizer. So if you think about most social enterprise products, it costs more to do the right things. If you think of fair trade coffee as an example, great, the farmers are being paid a reasonable, sustainable price. You know, there's potentially other things in the supply chain being fixed, but that means a more expensive bean at the end of the day. Now, we recognized in ticketing there were excessive fees being charged, and to do the right thing with our model doesn't cost extra. And so we've actually come in, and when people switch from incumbents like Eventbrite to Humanitix, they actually save often 25, 30, 50% on the fees, and they get to do good. So there's no ethical tax built into our pricing point, which means you get the ethical event organizers, you get the very wealthy event organizers, and you get everyone else who's just trying to survive.
In general, what do you think is the most compelling part of your value proposition? The easy use of your platform, the lower fees, or the ethical proposition? What do you think is the one that really gets people?
I think it's actually the customer service.
The customer service.
So when you call a call center with a traditional for-profit ticketing platform, you're not treated very well. I don't know if you've ever had a ticket issue, but it's worse than calling the banks. I'll put it that way. When you call Humanitix.
Or an airline.
Or an airline. Yeah, there's lots of things. Or a utility provider.
I've been on phone with Alaska Air for hours and hours, especially during COVID. But
so one of the, you know, we had an issue with access to capital being a nonprofit, but where we have an amazing we think, advantage is that when you join Humanitix as an employee and you join our, say, customer success team, you're incredibly inspired by the mission. You know that you're making a real impact if you do a great job. So when you speak to an event organizer or patron to the event, you want them to love Humanitix. You want to go above and beyond so they have a great experience and tell their friends to switch, because then we're just going to give more this year. And so our office is full of passionate, ethical people who are motivated and incredibly intelligent often, and you wouldn't find them in a traditional for-profit ticketing platform. And so that's a massive competitive advantage, and we see almost no churn in our client base because our clients love us, because it's just so refreshing to have that service level.
I'm familiar with the idea of extraordinary customer service helping build a company. The company that I was president of for years and was head of stores before that was selling a commodity, a suit. I mean, men don't want to wear a suit. Most men don't really care about the suit. They just don't want to look stupid. So when they come into the store, they want to buy a suit that's not very expensive, and they just say, please don't let me look stupid. So they're looking for really good customer service, but they're buying a commodity. So really the only thing that differentiated us from our competition was a somewhat lower price, same as Humanitix, but really this customer service to help men not look stupid. Whereas if they went to a department store, who knows what would happen? And even if they brought their wife, they may still look stupid. So I believe that customer service can be the differentiator. Our company essentially consolidated the tailored clothing industry in both Canada and the United States with that very model. I mean, we had other things that were good, but we had to build a culture within the company in 650 stores that could support that kind of customer service. So before we go on, tell me a little bit about how you keep your employees motivated beyond the ethical part. I mean, how do you compensate them? They don't have any equity. It's a different thing than going into a traditional tech company.
We run a pretty interesting recruitment process where it starts with screening steps, then technical interviews, but then it actually goes into values interviews. And that goes for about 3 hours, where they meet a range of different people in the organization, and we're effectively sifting for people that believe in our mission and want to see this change in the world. And so it's not good enough that you're just technically good for the role. You actually have to be philosophically and ethically aligned with the change we're trying to create in the world. And that means that when people join us, once they've been through that process, if we've got it right, they're intrinsically motivated to kick ass at their role, understanding that there's a lot more at stake here and there's a lot more good for the world if they do a great job. And so, you know, there's no equity in Humanitix. We're not looking to ever sell. It creates a very different dynamic. If me and Adam were looking to sell Humanitix as an IPO in the next 2 years or whatever, that a trade sale, then maybe we'd put up with an asshole in the office who was bloody good at their job and was going to increase our revenue by 10%, because it's a short-term trade for, you know, a very good reason. But when you're building something to make impact over time and there's no clear exit strategy, it changes the way you hire. And so that's been a really interesting evolution so far.
I would like to get to two things. One, what's happened? You had this idea. You decided to become more intentional in Sri Lanka. You kept your friendship together. You built Humanitix. So I want to know how successful you've been and where you're going from a financial point of view. And then I'd like to get to who's going to benefit from that. You're going to benefit because I hope and assume you pay yourself a decent salary, but knowing you probably not an extraordinary salary, but the tech industry founders and people who are leading organizations should and do make quite well. But most of their money is going to come from their equity, which you don't have. But who benefits? So how have your numbers worked? What's your growth trajectory? And then where do you think you can go? And then who ultimately is benefiting? And I want to be specific, like which charities, which organizations at this point. I know that it could change over time.
Humanitix, obviously starting in Australia, has our head office still here in Australia. We then subsequently expanded into New Zealand with an office in Auckland. 2 years ago, expanded into Denver for the US operation. And now we're in the process of expanding into the UK, which is really, really exciting. So currently active in 3 markets with locations in Australia, New Zealand, and the US, soon to be the UK as the 4th. It's been a phenomenal growth journey for us. We've gotten to the stage now where to date, we have given away $6 million to our partner charities. I'll get into who in a moment. To give you a sense of how quickly that's growing, this year alone, we gave four. Last year, we gave one. The year before that, hundreds of thousands of dollars. Last year was super exciting. The year before was super exciting, where for the first time, we gave away $1 million of profit. You know, isn't that amazing? The next year, we did four. This calendar year, we'll see where we end up, but we're certainly going to far exceed the $4 million we gave last year. We'll probably double our impact in total just from the giving we give this year.
And I just want to remind the audience who may not be thinking about it from a business point of view, we're talking about the net profits. We're not talking about what in Australia they would call the turnover, but in the United States we call the volume. The volume is the big number that wheedles down after all expenses to the profit. So when Adam talks about giving away $4 million last year, that's the net profit. That's not the big number. What was the revenue number that went to that $4 million?
I don't have it on hand. I don't have it on hand.
But it was over $200 million?
No, that would be transaction value.
Okay.
Our revenue is about, call it roughly 5% of the transaction value.
Oh, okay.
Because when you buy a $100 ticket, maybe the fee is $5. The $100 goes straight to the event organizer. That's not our money. But, you know,
you explained this to me on the phone when I think last time I was here. I was in Tasmania. So, I was a little distracted.
High level numbers, like, 2024 is a moving target, but it's looking like we'll sell around $400 million in tickets, of which we'll have about $20 million in our revenue being booking fees. Those booking fees cover things like credit card processing. It's actually quite a low margin industry. But we're hoping this year to generate somewhere between $8 and $12 million to our projects. So that's almost a 50% profit margin on our revenue, which is phenomenal. That is much higher than the profit margins of all our competitors that we can see that are public. And so we've worked really hard. We've got an amazing team doing a lot. And we, you know, as a registered charity, we actually get quite a lot of support from different partners. You know, that helps.
Just that, that's what's so exciting about this social enterprise model. In that, you know, to begin with, Humanitix raised money from philanthropists, you know, high net worth people who saw the potential for Humanitix. The reason why they were excited to give us money was in the hope that we'd get to where we are today. And that is giving away millions of dollars in profit while simultaneously funding our own operation, not needing to ask anybody else for a cent in order for the operation to keep funding itself.
It's actually very similar to the people who support The Life You Can Save. They support The Life You Can Save so we can grow and therefore give more money to the 27 nonprofits that we support.
Exactly. Humanitix is registered as a charity in order to keep the equity situation watertight. So there's no shareholders, you know, under the covers or anything like that. But fundamentally different from a charity in that every year we're not fundraising from people in order to pass that on to do our work. Instead, we're running a business that has removed shareholders and replaced those shareholders with partner charities who receive the profits of the operations of the business. In the same way that the shareholders of any business don't receive all the revenue that the business makes, otherwise they'd sink the business, they're in it to share in the profits. And that's how shareholders become insanely wealthy from the capitalist model. And so what Humanitix does is it says, ooh, if you can make shareholders with that model insanely wealthy by doing business that way, what if you replace them with charity partners and made the charity partners insanely wealthy with the exact same capitalist principles at play?
Hi, I'm Roy Head, the CEO of Development Media International. You're familiar with ads that sell products like shampoo and beer and medications. Well, we make ads too, but our radio and television actually save children's lives. They're scientifically evaluated and they're aired on radio stations in sub-Saharan Africa, encouraging mums to bring their young children and babies suffering from severe diarrhea or malaria or pneumonia for life-saving treatment in community health centres and hospitals. The Life You Can Save has been instrumental in raising funds to support our work. Please visit thelifeyoucansave.org/musings to find out how to save lives.
As someone who's been raising money, sometimes referred to as begging for money, for the last 10 years, who doesn't have this type of social enterprise model but has a more traditional nonprofit model, for the audience that doesn't know, The Life You Can Save is a meta charity, the organization that Peter and Singer and I co-founded. And what that means is we raise money for our organization, but the main purpose is to raise money for the 27 partner charities that we support. So we need money to keep our operation going. We don't generate that money. And the big advantage of the Humanitix or social enterprise model is that while we're begging for money and spending our time doing that, Adam and Josh are running a business that's generating that money and that they're not in need of any more capital. At the beginning, I know the Atlassian Foundation and others were probably very helpful to you, but now you're generating your own capital.
So our pitch to philanthropists in Australia 8 years ago was, we don't know exactly, but it's going to cost roughly $3 to $4 million to build this engine. And then into perpetuity, we believe it can be giving hundreds of millions to the same things we all care about. So that's a better spend of your philanthropic dollar. And excitingly, for under $4 million, we've built Australia and New Zealand, and it's already given $6.5 million to its projects, but now is a sustainable donation stream of roughly $10 million a year and still growing.
And where you've referred when we've talked privately to your base case view and your dream, but where would you like to be, say, 5 years from now, given this growth trajectory, or 10 years from now? What are your thoughts about that? I think the audience would be very interested in hearing that.
Yeah, our short to medium term goal being like 3 to 5 years. We've set it up in North America. It's going fantastically well. And we're setting up in the UK right now. If we can replicate the success of Australia, New Zealand, and North America, that should equate in 5 years to 100 million US a year sustainably going into our projects. If we get it right in the UK, we'll probably be 2x of Australia. So call another 20 odd million, but pounds.
So that's 3 to 5 years just to contextualize it. The Life You Can Save has given away approximately $100 million over 10 years. So in 3 to 5 years, Humanitix could be doing on an annual basis what it took 10 years for The Life You Can Save to do. Now, GiveWell, because they have very, very wealthy partners, are raising a lot more money than The Life You Can Save, but still $100 million is, I would say, not only disrupting the ticketing industry, but one could think of it as disrupting the very industry that I've been a part of, which I think is fantastic.
That's the goal for us. What makes us so excited is seeing how achievable this goal of giving away $100 million a year sustainably is. And that's because to do that, event hosts who currently use a different ticketing platform need to be made aware that Humanitix exists. Often it's a lack of knowledge. Once they see it, once they play around with it, they say, oh my God, the platform's better. The booking fees are lower. All these profits go to charity. There's someone to talk to. And the person I talk to is lovely. What the hell have I been doing this whole time? And so to have the foundational software and business structure set up that can service our industry better than the incumbents currently, and it's now just a matter of event hosts knowing and switching to Humanitix at no trade-off, that's what makes the goal so achievable.
So we can talk about the marketing challenge in a bit, just briefly. But what I'd like to do now is get into who are the beneficiaries of this money that you're raising to this point and in the future. And I know you haven't decided who are going to be the beneficiaries. I know there'll be organizations like The Life You Can Save and like the organizations that we support. So I have to say that's one of the reasons I'm so excited about Humanitix.
Yeah. Our choice of charity partners has predictably changed over the years and will continue to change as we learn more and more about which charities are doing the best stuff and who's the most impactful and where our dollar should go. And that's why teaming up with The Life You Can Save and other groups who are focused on finding those charities is such an amazing fit. Who we've given to date has been quite a cool and interesting story, a lot of pragmatism in the process. When we started, we did not have a ticketing platform, so we dedicated all our resources to building the most competitive ticketing platform in order to start selling tickets. Now, that meant that we started off by using common sense, a decent selection of a range of local and international charities who have a strong reputation and are highly regarded. And that was across charities in health, kids' education, environment, Indigenous affairs here in Australia being a massive challenge. And there are a range of great charities that we've supported today, Smith Family, Oz Harvest, Red Cross, you name it. And that's where we started, with the idea that let's just give away what we can to great charities that seem to be doing a reasonably good job. When we've grown our business to being actually a good business that can service the events industry with a great ticketing solution, then that might be the space where that we'll have to start to optimize which charities we're giving to. Earlier than expected, we were able to optimize that. And that's when we came across the Atlassian Foundation, who supported Humanitix when we were raising money. And we found out that this foundation of Atlassian is filled with the most amazing people who spend their time, rather than trying to help Atlassian from a marketing optics perspective, which is what some company foundations do, rather than doing that, they were doing the most authentic, real job of finding the most impactful charities, in their case, focused on kids' education, to give the foundation money to. And so we said, well, great. Who do you give to and why? And it turns out in the charity sector, there's no reason to hoard IP of what charities are doing the best job. You want to share that. And so we cottoned onto that. And that's really what started that phase of the journey where we recognized we need to both internally be thinking ourselves and hiring our own people to be looking at who are the charities we want to be giving to. But even more beyond that, with so much more leverage, we want to be making friends with great people, foundations, the life you can save, groups who are dedicating their time and attention to finding the world's best charities. So with Atlassian, we started then donating to Room to Read. They focus specifically on girls' education prominently across Southeast Asia and parts of particularly sub-Saharan Africa, noting that if you invest in girls' education in those parts of the world, you get the most phenomenal outcome, intergenerational wealth, appreciation of the value of education, and it has this whole trickle-down effect for the family. We also, as a result of that relationship, have given a lot of money to Code.org. Code.org started in America and then have grown now to be global. They're looking at the value of teaching kids and giving any kid, no matter their background or access to resources, access to quality computer science education. Maths and literacy historically has been the obvious foundational education to give any child and continues to be. But now with the way the world's going, adding computer science to that seems like a really logical, high-impact thing to do, particularly with how distributable and scalable computer science education is and how to use computer science if you simply have access to a laptop and an internet connection and you have the skills in computer science, you can totally transform yours and your family's life. And so that's a super interesting, compelling insight we got and have given them a fortune of money. We continue to look at more and more of these partner charities, now predominantly in health and education spaces. I think what's going to be really exciting now is, you know, taking more advice now from the life you can save and really getting more ingrained into these partner charities all around the world. We intentionally have both a domestic pool of charities we support in every market that we operate, as well as an international pool of charities that we fund, noting that a life is a life. And there's also a very compelling story to be told around making domestic impact for event hosts so that event hosts themselves who are switching to Humanitix can tell their community not just the good they're doing, but also the local good that they're doing, which is very, very important for community building, which is all what events are about. And quite a very important and good fit for the industry that we operate in.
You've given last year a fair amount of money to The Life You Can Save. I'd like to ask a rhetorical question since I think I know the answer, but would like the audience to hear it. Why did you give money to The Life You Can Save itself for its own operations?
We believe in the work The Life You Can Save are doing immensely. And we believe in the authenticity and intention of the people involved at The Life You Can Save, of this mission of finding this phenomenal group of charities who need more money to do some of the best work possible in this world that can be aptly funded by companies like Humanitix. We believe in the organization. We believe in the people who are a part of it. At the end of the day, that's who you...
Well, obviously I do too, but you're in a lot of ways, I think you're leveraging Katie Stanford and Matthias Nestore, who are our key research people, but you're giving the money so that you can find out which charities you might want to consider giving more money to. So it's a very synergistic relationship.
We talked before about the role of meta-charities, and I just wanted to share with the audience one thing that isn't always obvious, but what's very exciting about social enterprise and the Humanitix type model is that this annuity donation stream we're building doesn't cannibalize existing philanthropy. And so if and when we get to giving $100 million a year to our programs, that is a creative new value for the world's best charities. So often when a charity does a good marketing campaign, it's just cannibalizing grants that were going to the other charity down the road. And that's great if this charity that got the better marketing campaign is a fantastic charity, but that's actually totally irrelevant to what actually happens in the world. It's got, you know, there's not that feedback loop between a good charity and its marketing initiatives. They're not tied together. And so we're in a very exciting phase here. And we hope a lot of other entrepreneurs see this opportunity where you can create an ethical alternative that substantially moves the world forward with a whole new bucket of resources.
It's an exciting partnership for the life you can save too, because the work that Katie and Matthias do in discovering these great charities and researching them, just like GiveWell does as well, or Founders Pledge, there are a number of these organizations, but we want to share our information with Humanitix. It's not like it's proprietary, and you want to share your money with the life you can save and our recommended charities. And so that's another thing that in some ways disrupts the traditional, this is my company, I'm just going to keep the money where it is, I'm just going to keep the intellectual property where it is. This is where the intellectual property is completely open on our side, and it benefits the people we're all trying to help.
One of the hopes we have is that the people funding the GiveWells and Founders Pledges of the world, the penny drops that, okay, you are giving $1 million to, say, the Against Malaria Foundation for very good reason. It has been shown to you that that is one of the most effective interventions in the world, and you care about the philanthropic return on your investment. Now, if you can find another Humanitix, then you can deploy your capital and create leverage on that capital into the exact same thing, in which case now this is the most effective use of your philanthropic capital. And as someone who's made money in technology or venture capital, you have the skills to support that and do that. And we think it's one of the best models at hand to do philanthropy.
I completely agree, having been a fundraiser for the life you can save. It seems to me we also get leverage. We think that we've raised about $15 for every dollar we've spent. So we have a leverage model. It's not as powerful as the social enterprise model when it's successful. Mm. It's dramatically more successful than social enterprises that fail. So if people can develop these social enterprises that are as successful as Humanitix, then we could evolve into just creating the information that these social enterprises could use in choosing where they give money or how they market themselves to increase their social enterprise. So again, I think there's a very bright future for the relationship between the Life You Can Save, which is a leverage organization, and then you all, which create greater leverage on the initial investment that was made as you grow. And
yeah. I'd also like to clear up a confusion that I see a lot in social enterprise, in that social enterprise and a Humanitix like social enterprise doesn't replace the traditional charity model at all. It complements it. There's been, since this exciting world of a social enterprise being sustainable has popped up, and in Humanitix's case, we've made that doable, possible. The expectation then goes to traditional charities to say, oh, how do we make every charity sustainable, not requiring donations every single year? If that was possible, and it might be, that would be great. I currently can't see how that's doable and how that's even optimal. Take Humanitix, for example. We run now a successful business that produces a surplus profit that we give away to great charities. If we were to, instead of giving that profit away, use that profit to fund our own programs to educate kids, protect the environment, all that kind of stuff, that would make us look very good. But we do a terrible job. Because what the hell do we know about how personally to educate a child in a particular community, or, you know, go down a particular rabbit hole of expertise of how to do good? There are organizations, great charities there, who focus all their time on solving these challenges and problems of expertise. The tragedy is that they're distracted by fundraising. To me, the utopia is that frontline charities can solely focus on doing their frontline impact and not have to worry about fundraising, because more and more Humanitixes of the world are popping up that say, we're your fundraising stream. Here's all of our profit. So we're going to focus on making the profit. We've teamed up with you because we believe in you to effect change, and you're going to focus exclusively on creating that change. That to me is the optimal model, as opposed to the social enterprise trying to do the frontline work and the charity trying to raise money on the side of doing their frontline work. Everyone's got their heads split, and focusing on one lane and teaming up and collaborating is, I think, the next leap we can make in real charity efficiency, and not confusing the concepts that the one ought to be the other.
I think that's very well stated. I have another question, which is, what is the relationship between what you're doing, the social enterprise model, and traditional capitalism? We understand how it's different in terms of, in one model like a Delaware corporation in the United States, the leaders are, by law, have to prioritize shareholder value, which is, of course, not something that you need to worry about. You don't even need to be a B Corp like we have in the United States, where you're sort of splitting shareholder value with social good. Where does social enterprise, if you think of Delaware, I'm using the United States because that's what I'm familiar with. You have Delaware corporations that have to maximize shareholder value. I helped run a company like that, which is why I said I was kind of stuck, kind of like Josh was in his early days, because I had to think about shareholder value before anything else, even before the value for our employees. The justification for doing good for our employees was it would increase shareholder value. And I happened to work for a company that really believed that. You don't have that problem. B Corps, which we won't get into, have a little bit of a split. They're not obligated 100% to maximize shareholder value. But now we have these social enterprises. How widespread do you think what social enterprises can become? And to what extent does it disrupt traditional capitalism, which I would call in the U.S. Delaware corporations? Is that a clear question? Is that clear?
I think we're only relaxing one key assumption of capitalism, which is that the entrepreneur does what they do purely to maximize profit for themselves. That is the efficient man. And we see in all walks of life that that's not true for a lot of people. When someone decides to become a nurse or a teacher, they're deciding a very different path and then almost never doing that to pursue maximizing their personal wealth. And so that's the key assumption. And in every other way, like, capitalism is an amazing model that's lifted more people out of poverty than any other system that we've devised of. So we're not trying to throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, let's burn it to the ground and ban for-profit ticketing platforms or anything like that. We're just saying, that's not true for us. We know it's not true for a lot of other people. And so let's relax that assumption. We are going to build a sustainable organization that doesn't just chase wealth generation at all costs. And there's a lot of amazing for-profit businesses out there that, if they have the right shareholders, can behave responsibly. But one of the fundamental problems with markets today is that when a company gets so big and then lists and has shareholders who don't have true skin in the game because they can sell their shares at any point in time, you know, unless the founders have retained voting rights or something like that, it becomes a faceless shareholder company that's traded on the free market. And then the management team is beholden to very short-term metrics, and everything becomes about maximizing profit no matter what the true cost. And so negative externalities don't get considered. We're in an incredibly privileged position where we are still trying to maximize our profit for our projects, but we don't have to do it at the where it becomes a trade-off with negative externalities. We can choose an ethical path in that situation. So we can grow slower because we don't want to, say, ruin the planet or, you know, a lot of the things that go wrong at scale. That's how I think of it. I think we're almost identical in many respects, just a fundamental shift in incentives.
It's really exciting that the humanetics model of social enterprise has, and we'll see it as we continue to scale, seems to have an inbuilt circuit breaker for these negative externalities. Obviously, the shareholder is the one that loses. And to your question, every business on the planet, in every industry, could be dominated by a social enterprise like humanetics. There's no reason why that can't happen, where the leading player or all the players in the industry decide to give their profits away to great charities instead of enriching shareholders. Totally possible. Why is humanetics interesting is because when you have these negative externalities arising, like Josh is talking about, a company is trying to make its shareholders wealthy whilst not getting in trouble with the regulator for that industry. And then it becomes the regulator's job to try to close as many loopholes for the company as possible. But in truth, the company is not always going to do this, but they're heavily incentivized to work within the regulatory framework and find holes and gaps within what the regulators provided. in order to gain an advantage to produce more profit to enrich their shareholders. And then it's up to the regulator to respond to that. A humanities-like social enterprise, it makes no sense to do that. Firstly, there's no shareholders at the end of the day to make wealthy. The only groups and people you're trying to make wealthy are your charity partners in order to do good with the world, for the world. And so why would you find a gap in the regulatory framework to screw over or create some negative externality over here in order to produce more profits so you can fund more kids' education over there? That wouldn't happen. And that's what excites me most. And that's what I'm most excited to see as Humanitix scales to hopefully be a very, very large company giving hundreds of millions of dollars away a year, to see that play out. Of course, this doesn't replace the regulator, but it means that the regulator doesn't have to be as good when you have a company structured like this with the incentives that a social enterprise like Humanitix is orientated like. And it seems undoubtedly to me, no question, that if more companies were structured like Humanitix, wouldn't have nearly as many of the issues that we're seeing today, where companies are having to be kept honest and some regulator is having to put companies in line to not create these negative externalities in order to enrich their shareholders.
In the United States, there's a real challenge to having regulators altogether.
Right.
And that, I won't get into that. That's right. A whole other issue, is whether we should even have regulators or whether free market capitalism just, I mean, I would put it as runs amok. But again, I don't think we need to get into that. I agree with the fundamental assumption that there are talented people across the economic spectrum, from the working class all the way through very well-educated people who really don't think primarily about enriching themselves. They think they want a decent living for their families, but that's not, their goal is to do good, and that it makes them feel better to do good. And whether there could be social enterprises like Humanitix all over the place because there are just all these people waiting to do that, or whether it's a more limited group, is really subject for another discussion or maybe even
or consumer-driven, where consumers become more accustomed to seeing social enterprises in various industries and start to say, hey, why isn't there a social enterprise in this industry? Consumers voting with their dollar is perhaps where that will come from, as opposed to hoping on the goodwill of future entrepreneurs.
But I think what is really interesting is that you were two people, along with your families, because I highlight your families because you're in this journey together, are people that are trying to do good in the world, still trying to live a nice life, but not at the expense of these negative externalities, and on top of that, having the potential to do a tremendous amount of good. I mentioned at the beginning the numbers. If a company is, even at your base case, 3 to 5 years, churning $100 million in profit, I hope that the listeners understand what that company could be sold for and make the two of you and your families extraordinarily wealthy, like what has happened with a lot of tech founders. I'm not going to say what those numbers are, but they're very big. And we see these people who are billionaires now who have become billionaires because of their ability to create a tech company and then sell it or have an IPO, which is a different form of selling it on the open market. So that's why I mentioned how you're extraordinarily generous, but also very clever to make this work. I appreciate what you're doing as somebody at the Life You Can Save and as someone who supports the kinds of charities that you all support. Is there anything I haven't asked you today that you think would be interesting for our listeners to hear?
I just want to share one last point, what we were talking about before with regulation and the role of social enterprise in society. Look, we're not hippies thinking suddenly every industry is going to become full of altruistic people who are happy to disrupt and not build equity value. But what would be really cool and what is feasible in the next 20 years is in industries that are somewhat commoditized, where it's not rocket science, if the incumbent for-profit platforms are being terrible social actors, then smart philanthropists with smart social entrepreneurs should team up to disrupt it. And in pockets of society, we can fix massive problems at scale through that strategy. And that is very feasible. And that's what we're dreaming to do with our careers. And there are other people doing it. And so I think, as you know, if you think of it like as a tactical guerrilla warfare trying to fix the world, like, you've got different industries being tackled. I've got no illusion that this is going to work across all industries, and not all industries are as equally easy to disrupt. Some of them are a lot more capital intensive, but in software, it's incredibly capital light. And so that's kind of the dream there.
Well, it may be capital light, but it's brain heavy. So I want to compliment you on your success, which we've actually passed over in a lot of ways. Like, oh, we just grew this company, and other people can do that too. Not so easy. And I want to thank you so much for being who you are and being on the podcast, and for the help that you're giving The Life You Can Save and will continue to give to The Life You Can Save, because we have the same interest, which is finding great nonprofits that are helping the ultimate beneficiaries that we care about, who are people living in poverty and who can be helped and who just haven't won the birth lottery. So they're in a very different situation in their life than we in Australia are, particularly those of us that are middle class or working class or wealthy, versus the people who just can't get out of poverty without help. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Charlie. It's also just more fun this way, personally. I can't stress that enough to anyone who's thinking about going down this path. Josh and I have talked about it all the time. If we had gone the traditional route of Humanitix being a for-profit company, we would be more wealthy right now, no doubt. But our lives are more enjoyable now. Our experience of running a company, rather than having to keep VCs happy constantly worrying about who's going to maybe acquire us, oh, who's going to come on our board now from such and such a venture capitalist company, where are we going to raise money from next, how do we reach their growth target on their metrics of their own fund, that sucks, and everyone knows it. And well, when you do it this way, it's so much more fun. So
I'm
if
envious.
You're doing it for yourself alone, go for it.
Because I wasn't in that position. Probably I wasn't clever enough to do what you did, but I'm glad that I got out 10 years ago and started working with Peter at The Life You Can Save.
There you go.
So thank you very
much. Something.
Can I make one ask of the audience?
Yes.
If you're a journalist, please reach out to us. The more people that know about this idea, they switch. And the quicker we can build brand equity and awareness in North America and the UK, the quicker we'll be giving $100 million. On our current trajectory, it's going to take 3 to 5 years to get from 10 to 100, but that could be a lot quicker.
Well, let me add to Josh's comment, because not just for journalists, but there are a lot of people listening to the podcast that have large networks of people and platforms. So I think we should just be spreading the word, and that's one of the reasons for doing this podcast today. So let's spread the word, unless you can come up with a reason why people should buy tickets at Ticketmaster or Eventbrite. But I'm pretty well sold. Unfortunately, I don't host events or buy tickets, but I do want to help spread the word. So thanks again.
Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Musings About Ourselves and Other Strangers. Subscribe and join us. Our guests have varied experiences, different points of view, and interesting ideas about what it means to live a well-balanced moral life. We hope you'll share this podcast with those close to you. We'd also like to invite you to rate and review this podcast on whatever platform you use. And if you're interested in learning more about The Life You Can Save and the charities we benefit, visit thelifeyoucansave.org/musings.